This show is brought to you by 13 Turns, a new horror anthology by Kevin Carr. 13 jolting tales of terror, murder, and the macabre. Only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Greetings, couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, we're going to be talking about the new summer films, The Conjuring 2, Warcraft, Now You See Me 2, and then the smaller releases, Maggie's Plan and Rabin, The Last Day. I'll also be talking about the news, the trailer park, box office predictions, and of course, the home cinema roundup. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com and facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Thank you, Ron Burgundy. Let's jump right into the news. The first piece of news actually concerns one of our releases this week, and that is Warcraft. I'll talk about the box office later near the end of the show, but it kind of made news leading up to its release this week because it did unprecedentedly well in China. If you don't understand how movies work nowadays, it's a global marketplace. There are movies that don't do well at all in America. Movies like, say, Battleship, or even Terminator Genesis from last year, didn't do terribly well in America, but boy, they go great guns overseas. And in fact, there are some movies like Pacific Rim, which came out a couple years ago, that did marginally well in America, but it did extremely well overseas, especially in Asia, that it's enough to greenlight a sequel to it, which they're making right now. Now, China is big on World of Warcraft. I mean, the game was big back then when it started, and it still has a lot of fans there. And fantasy movies do extremely well, including The Mermaid, which is one of the biggest grossing movies of the year that most people in America haven't even heard of. It's a Chinese release that's of fantasy elements as well. What's interesting is when I saw the movie this week, there were the names of all the production companies. I mean, you see Legendary Pictures and Blizzard and Universal show up at the beginning. But as you go through, there's so many sub-production companies, and there were a bunch of them from China that were Chinese names or I recognized from other movies that were financed in China. China has been sinking a lot of money and interest into movies, in particular because it's such a huge market. I mean, it's a billion people, and it's recently opened up, and they can control which movies get exported from America there, and you pick and choose. And some movies like Star Wars just doesn't really catch on in China, but like Warcraft is going to. Now, that has no bearing on what's going to happen in America. Part of the other reason why these movies tend to do well, movies like the Transformers films, which do extremely well in China, or the Fast and Furious movies, they're not high on story. They're action, they're spectacle, they're escapism, they're stuff you don't even need to understand the language to participate in. And that's a lot of what Warcraft is. It's just a lot of fighting and special effects on screen. You don't have to hear what they're saying to understand that there's a battle going on. And it's pretty clean cut. You got the giant orcs and you got the humans. So it plays to an international multilingual audience who maybe isn't going to be reading all the subtitles. Another piece of news that I found kind of fascinating, and this is a little bit of an old news, is apparently there people are claiming there's a lesbian couple in the trailer for Finding Dory, which I find hilarious because the people that are upset by that seem to forget who actually plays the title character. I mean, Ellen DeGeneres is probably the most famous lesbian in America. But of course, Dory is asexual. She just is Dory. They don't put it in the movie. Well, apparently there's this shot in the trailer where it appears that there are two women there and they might be two moms, but it could just be two mothers in a playground with each other's kids. I mean, they just could be two people. People are reading a lot into this. And honestly, we don't know, but does it really matter? But there has been a lot of pressure and talk about LGBT characters being absent in just in Hollywood in general. In Disney movies, and there's been talks of people sort of like doing that online Twitter demanding a girlfriend for Elsa in Frozen, saying, well, maybe she's a lesbian because she doesn't have a boyfriend. The movie's not about a love relationship with her. Another one that I find fascinating is there's this group that has latched on to Poe Dameron from Star Wars, the character played by Oscar Isaac, and saying that he's gay. And people are demanding that Disney make a stand on this and make the characters openly, outwardly gay. And look, that's not going to happen. You can demand it all you want on Twitter with hashtags and whatnot. That's not going to happen. These are massive blockbusters intended for the widest audience possible. They are not platforms for social evolution. Even though sometimes movies will sneak that stuff in, Disney doesn't need to do that. And if you want to see something done by Disney that is LGBT friendly, there's a whole host of television shows that this is involved. You don't need to put it in a Star Wars movie. And I think the reality is that's the way films work. Unless you have a love story, a very specific love story, or a very specific character that's married, generally the sexuality of the other characters, aside from the one or two main ones, is not even mentioned because it's not relevant to the story. And that kind of begs a question. Could any of the characters in Disney movies or Star Wars movies, could they have been gay? I mean, a lot of people always speculated Scar was gay in The Lion King. I don't know if they made it. Maybe that's just the way Jeffrey Irons portrayed him and how he got animated. The bottom line is 95% of characters in movies, their sexuality and who they date and who they're married to is unimportant to the story. But I mean, look at Jungle Book, for example. Big one out right now because it's the live action one. Baloo could be gay. Or what about a Bagheera or King Louie? They never at all mention their sexuality, male or female. Any member of the Lost Boys in Peter Pan could have been gay. I mean, you had this sort of like flirty relationship between Peter Pan and Wendy, but aside from that, who knows? Cruella De Vil could have been the most evil lesbian in Dogtown. Or look at Star Wars, Ben Kenobi. Or any Jedi, aside from Anakin, because he specifically had a love interest that propelled the story. I mean, I don't know, maybe in the extended universe it shows up, but in sort of the Disney canon, who knows? Or Palpatine, the Emperor, he could have been gay. The point is that you didn't know if Palpatine liked boys or girls, because it was irrelevant to the story. And for movies, a lot of these movies, they, especially Disney movies, there needs to be procreation, and they didn't have fertility clinics in the Great Barrier Reef, and they didn't have fertility clinics on the Serengeti in The Lion King to produce a lion cub, or the Wicked Stepmother. That's, you know, these take place in old kingdoms. They didn't have artificial insemination back then. The bottom line is, this is overanalyzing what are essentially very simple stories, and you don't need to force it in a movie, because if you suddenly be like, we're doing a movie about the first gay character in Star Wars, it becomes a movie about a gay character, not about Star Wars. Because Star Wars is not about sexuality. The Disney films are not about sexuality. They're bigger concepts aimed at kids that transcend any one specific moniker. Listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. It's been out for a couple weeks, but I finally wanted to play it. Assassin's Creed, which opens on December 21st.
What kind of prison is this?
It's not a prison. You're about to enter the Animus. What you're about to see, hear, and feel are the memories of your ancestor, who's been dead for 500 years. Welcome to the Spanish Inquisition.
I am a god, even though I'm a man of God. My whole life in the hand of God, so y'all better quit playing with God.
The trailer looks cool. Everything about the trailer looks like this might be a neat movie until the rap music starts, and they lost me completely. Now, I understand that there's not probably going to be rap music in the movie as a soundtrack any more than there was in 42 with Jackie Robinson that took place in the movie. I mean, they have it in the trailer, and they have it in the credits. But I thought that just ruined what could have otherwise been a decent trailer. But I don't know. Marion Cotillard, I'm so over her. I don't find her interesting or a good actor. She's really suppressing her accent in this movie, at least in the trailer clips. Fassbender, I think, is great. But this is just another video game movie. Have you even learned anything? I mean, we got Warcraft coming up this week, doing well in China. We'll see what my review is on that later. But, you know, Resident Evil and maybe the first Mortal Kombat? Maybe Angry Birds? It's so rare to find a video game movie that actually does well. And there's reasons for that. I'll talk about that when we talk about Warcraft, which will take place at the end of the other break, along with Now You See Me 2. Kevin Carr's new horror anthology, 13 Turns, brings you a series of stories inspired by H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, The Twilight Zone, and classic gothic horror. A man is trapped, forced to murder himself every day of his unnatural life. Necromancers resurrect two famous figures from history for sport. A beautiful day in an amusement park turns into a murder investigation after a mysterious death on a roller coaster. A researcher in an abandoned prison discovers a portal to another dimension. 13 Turns by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies. Let's dive right into these movie reviews and start off with one of the many sequels that is hitting the theaters this week and overall throughout the summer, Now You See Me 2. The four horsemen get caught up in a new heist to steal a computer system for Harry Potter.
Are you listening, horsemen? You will get what's coming to you.
Thank you, everybody!
In ways you can't expect.
Now the greatest magicians in the world are mine. Magic trick.
Everyone get off the stage.
Somebody got the better of us, okay? Somehow.
Yes, you were lured into a trap.
Ta-da!
This is the key to every computer system on the planet. I want you to steal it for me.
You think we're still gonna play a little game?
I know you will.
Now I actually liked Now You See Me, the first one, quite a bit. I had a lot of fun with the movie. I thought the cast was really good. It was a nice, kind of spunky, fast little movie. And I mean, I like heist movies, and I like movies that deal with magic. You know, I've seen magic shows. There's like this sort of like this group of people that just hate magic, illusionists and that. But I have fun watching them. I've gone to Vegas. I've seen like David Copperfield, Lance Burton, and stuff like that. So I liked that first movie. It was fun. It was a disposable sort of action comedy. Now this one, obviously, because the movie sort of had these legs throughout the summer, did extremely well, especially worldwide, they, of course, wanted to make a sequel. Now, Ella Fisher's not in it because I think it was because she was pregnant during the filming of it. So they brought in Lizzie Kaplan just, I guess, to replace the girl. I mean, I guess you have to have a girl in the movie. That would have been, you know, bad for Hollywood to do that. This one's directed by John Chu, who is best known for the Step Up movies. And after seeing this movie, I thought to myself, well, that's exactly what you get with the director of the Step Up movies. It's a lot of flash and like too much flash. Now, it's been a while since I've seen the first movie, but I don't remember the magic being ridiculous. This is the nuance and the problem with doing magic in a movie is to actually make it realistically believable. Like there's a lot of things that like close-up magic, you know, people like David Blaine can do, and there's magic production acts, but they have them doing things in this movie that you're just like, there's just no way you can do that. That just is an impossibility, especially you can't plan on it being that way. Like at one point, and you see the clips in the trailer where they're stealing something out of a vault and it's on a card and they're literally flinging a card back and forth to each other. And I'm like, that is so choreographed. Again, being John Chu's forte, it becomes unbelievable. And like Woody Harrelson's character, who's, you know, they're in hiding, yet he's wearing that stupid hat all the time. He never changes his appearance at all. But he's a mentalist. He can mesmerize people and hypnotize people. But the hypnotism that he does is so stupid. It's just like, stop, boom, and he hypnotizes anybody. And hypnosis is a lot more complex than that. I mean, yeah, you can do showmanship, but you need to have the willing participant. And you can't, like, snap your fingers and hypnotize anybody and then have them completely under your control. It's sort of like Dracula in the original Todd Browning's Dracula, where he just comes in, he's like, you're under my control, go get me a ham sandwich, and go tell Dr. Van Helsing I'm here to see him. That is how ridiculous it gets. The first one really worked in sort of making the entire movie a magic trick, where there's a reveal, and there's tricks behind it, and then they can say, oh, this is how we did it. And this one just gets too silly. And here's the thing, I love Lizzie Kaplan. I think she's gorgeous, I think she's very funny, I think she's got great chemistry on screen and personality. They overuse her and they kind of play her off as the slapstick goofy person. And she's awful in this movie. And I hate that. I hate that because I love Lizzie Kaplan, but she's pretty awful in this film. The movie itself just doesn't work. It's a pale comparison to the first film. So I'm going to have to say that Now You See Me 2 kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Warcraft. This movie has been like years and years in the making. Warcraft was big, what, in the 90s? And even into the 2000s, it's kind of way past its prime. Anyways, director Duncan Jones brings the massive online video game World of Warcraft to life on the big screen, in which a legion of orcs invade a human realm to enslave them and take their resources.
War is coming.
An invasion.
If we do not unite to fight this enemy, our world will perish.
Saving the world is not a one-man job.
We fight together or we die together.
For as simple of a story as this movie is insanely convoluted. And part of it is there's mythology and lore in the game. And the game itself is extremely intricate. And people can play it for hours, so there's levels and things that happen, and they work all these into a script. But if you don't play Warcraft, it's just nonsense. 20 minutes into the movie, I'm thinking, what is the story? And I think back, oh yeah, the story's just that these orcs are coming after them, and they need to stop them. But I'm like, there's been so much needless, vapid plot development that makes no sense. The other big problem with it is the cast. There's no one of any note. And that this might save it in the sense that they didn't have to pay $100 million to get the cast to show up. But I mean, like, Paula Patton plays a female orc, and Paula Patton's not a good actor. She's beautiful. Yeah, she is a pretty woman, but she is not good. And she does not come across well in this movie. And Ben Foster plays like a Gandalf type wizard, sort of. And he's usually pretty good, but boy, he's terrible in this movie. The whole film just doesn't hold together. But the biggest problem with this movie, aside from the fact that it'll connect to nobody unless you're a diehard fan of the game, and it has nobody of any note in it, really, it's so overly CGI'd. CGI and computer technology has become so prevalent and so common in Hollywood, they use it for everything. You know, it used to be that you'd have these effect shots and they'd plan them because they're so expensive. Like the shots, if you go back to look at the original Jurassic Park, there's a lot of, you can see them economizing the shots in which the dinosaurs exist. And yeah, you know, when they did Jurassic World, they do a lot more with it. But what I'm getting tired of seeing is entire CGI elements where not a single thing is shot. It works in Avatar, but they also threw a lot of money into that movie. And there was technology that James Cameron was insisting upon. But this reminds me of, you know, about 10, 15 years ago, you started seeing driving in cars and they blue screen and green screen outside the car. And they started using compositing for that as opposed to rear projection because they could. And it always irritated me, but I know why they do it, because you can control the environment. And driving in a car, if you've got to strap cameras to it and you can't control the sound, you can't control the light or the temperature, you can control everything in the studio with the green screen. I understand why they do it, because mostly those shots are dialogue driven. But now you have movies that they just have everything CGI'd. I remember when I saw In the Heart of the Sea, which was that movie about Herman Melville and the Moby Dick inspiration. They like had Chris Hemsworth's character go home and he's in a farm and they've CGI'd background. And you're like, just go to a farm and shoot it. And that's the problem with the overly CGI'd Warcraft. The characters are so insane looking. They look like a video game, which isn't good. And then the sets, there's a scene where they're standing there and there's landscapes and mountains. And I'm like, why didn't you just shoot mountains? I can tell that you CGI'd all this stuff. It's just slapped together, a cheap Lord of the Rings ripoff. It's not very good. So I'm going to have to say Warcraft sucks.
It sucks.
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about another sequel, The Conjuring 2 and Maggie's Plan. Take a seasonal trip to the zombie apocalypse. Kevin Carr's new novelettes, Not the End and Gobble, offer a new take on the zombie nightmare. In Not the End, a man wakes up from a coma to find a viral outbreak has sent the world on the defensive. He must escape and learn the true nature of the zombies. The story Gobble takes the readers back to the beginning of the outbreak, which erupts at a tense Thanksgiving dinner. Not the End and Gobble by Kevin Carr are available now. Only 99 cents in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies, continuing with the movie reviews. Let's talk about another sequel, The Conjuring 2. James Wan directs a sequel about the Warrens traveling to London to help a family that is being haunted by a demon.
They're calling it England's Amityville. There is a family that desperately needs our help.
After everything we've seen, there isn't much that rattles either of us anymore. But this one... this one still haunts me.
She's such a good girl. What's wrong with her?
An oppressing spirit will try to force you to commit the ultimate sin.
And what's that?
Murder? Suicide? Or both?
If you're a listener to this show, you've heard me speak many occasions of this element of modern horror that I think is great, that James Wan has kind of pioneered. I'm not talking about stuff like Dead Silence. That wasn't very good. I'm talking about stuff like Insidious and The Conjuring that he has helped foster in this environment of found footage and jump scare movies. And he has gone the opposite direction of what you get with like found footage. It's very slow and deliberate, very composed shots. He uses a lot of practical effects that have been augmented by CGI rather than just throwing in CGI ghosts. I think that's a wonderful thing because James Wan has crafted a brilliant form of modern suspense filmmaking that was getting lost very quickly. And when he did Furious 7, that was fine. It was action filmmaking. It was nice to see him return to The Conjuring and return to horror. And we've got, we got that movie coming out later this summer. He is producing, he's not directing it, Lights Out, which looks like it's done in the same vein. And Sinister was another one that felt very much like this, even though James Wan had nothing to do with that. So it's nice to see it's kind of catching on. Now, The Conjuring in particular was a masterpiece in my opinion. I thought it was just such an extremely well-composed horror movie. The deliberate nature of it was perfect, and it really tapped into sort of like The Exorcist being very believable. I would in fact characterize The Conjuring as that first half of The Exorcist, where everything that happens in that first half of The Exorcist, you can believe really can happen. Maybe the bouncing on the bed, you if you could be like, oh, okay, well, yeah, the bed can move. That's the most it kind of gets out of reality. Now, when they get to the later half of The Exorcist, the it gets very big, vomiting pea soup, head spinning around, and levitation, the words help me showing up on her chest. But that first half of The Exorcist is very visceral and very grounded. And that's the way I felt The Conjuring was, as opposed to Insidious, which is very creepy and has some great background imagery. It's actually a great study of background imagery. And it's an effective movie, but the ghosts start to get a little bit, you know, the demon's literally there crouched behind a woman and with this Darth Maul face, and then they go into the nether, go into this sort of astral world. So it gets very high concept at a certain point. And I still appreciated that, and I appreciated Insidious 2, although it didn't stick the landing the way Insidious did. The Conjuring 2 feels much more like an Insidious movie because of that. And that's okay. It goes bigger and a little more Hollywood with its effects and what you see, and things could be questioned as hallucinations, but it feels more like an effect at times. I still think it's a good movie. It's a good haunting, but it does feel like Conjuring 2 feels like an Insidious movie that takes place in the Conjuring universe, which is okay because it didn't feel like The Conjuring 2 was just redoing the first Conjuring. I was okay with them going kind of a little bit off the reservation a bit. But it's ultimately a scary, creepy movie. Now, look, I have a friend who, he is a confirmed atheist. He hates ghost stories. Just hates them because he's like, they don't exist. They just don't exist. And they say it's based on a true story. That's BS. And he gets so mad at these. And I'm like, well, why do you watch them? He has no explanation as to why he watches these movies. But, you know, I say to him, I go, well, you can find a zombie movie scary.
their zombies aren't real. Why is it, what is it with ghosts? And it's an atheist thing, and I get it. So if you're like that, and you're annoyed with anything ghost story, why don't see this movie? Because that's what it is. It's a ghost story. I mean, it is, and it's saying it's based on a true story, which it's based on real things that happened, and you can decide whether they're true or not, but this is a real story that this was wrapped around, just as the Amityville is a real event with the Lutzes and how they were tied to this house. You can say, well, it's hogwash and it was all a hoax, and that's fine. But where's the fun in that? This is a ghost story. It's a movie, and it's meant to be that way. So you have to accept at least this in the 2 hours and 15 minutes you're in the movie theater. You just have to believe the movie, and it's a lot of fun. It's very well done. And, you know, you've got Ed and Lorraine Warren coming back. And so they're sort of all working with the same group, and that's nice. So I'm going to have to say The Conjuring 2 rocks. Good stuff. Spooky.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Maggie's Plan. Greta Gerwig stars as an independent woman who wants a child and concocts a benign plan on how to wean the child's father out of their relationship.
He's totally self-absorbed.
I'm terrified that I'm falling out of love with him.
It's too bad you can't give him back to his ex-wife, right?
Maggie, what are you doing here?
John and I are in trouble. There might be an opportunity to get the two of you back together.
You want to make sure you don't feel guilty, so you're going to manipulate us all.
Why can't you just break up with him like any normal human being?
Because it would be such a waste.
A waste? He's not a paper product.
First of all, this is one of those independent movies. It's what you totally expect to see Greta Gerwig in. If you don't know who Greta Gerwig is, you probably won't like this movie, because this is exactly the kind of movie she often stars in, stuff like Frances Ha, Lola Versus, pretty much anything by Noah Baumbach. She's done a couple appearances in big movies, but she never quite clicked. She's quirky and adorable. She's sort of like a Parker Posey, a modern Parker Posey, the way Parker Posey was in like the 90s, early 90s. This is Greta Gerwig. She doesn't really do much in the big movies, but these small, limited, independent films, she's fantastic, and she's very charming. I love Greta Gerwig. I think she is a beautiful woman, very compelling on screen, and she's very easy on the eyes, and she's very warm and inviting, and even if she's playing a character you might get a little annoyed with, you're okay with that, because she's just very, she's very charismatic. So this is not necessarily the movie I normally would gravitate towards, but I really enjoyed her part in it. It also has Ethan Hawke, who sometimes annoys me, but I respect the heck out of him for doing a lot of different stuff and a lot of independent stuff and smaller films. And you know, I have a lot of respect for him, even though he's not my favorite actor. This plays around with convention of romance stories, because it's about a whole series of relationships blowing up, but it's not done in like a bad sort of way, not in like a mean-spirited sort of way. The whole thing, Maggie's plan, you know, it's not like she's trying to get rid of her husband or the father of her daughter. She just says, you know, I'm falling out of love with him, so maybe he can go back to his ex-wife, who he was married to when they were having their affair. So it's this different take on relations, a very open and non-contentious way to approach this. And whereas she's just somewhat this natural, normal, pragmatic New Yorker, her husband, Ethan Hawke's character, and Julianne Moore, who plays his wife slash ex-wife, they're these raging academics who are snooty and much more emotional about these situations, but she's kind of, it presents her as being a little more elevated and sort of looking at this from the outside and saying, well, why don't we just change this up? And she just wanted a daughter. And she was, the whole thing in the story, she was going through artificial insemination processes, but she ended up having an affair with this guy and they got married and they had a kid. But it skewers modern relationships. It skewers modern thought in terms of relationship. It skews breakup and how we present ourselves and think of ourselves as single or attached and why we want to be that way. This is a great pairing of a film to watch with The Lobster, because both of them deconstruct modern relationships in very different ways. So Maggie's Plan, while it's not my cup of tea, I thought Greta Gerwig was quite charming in it. So I'm going to say for her, more than anything else, it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Rabin, The Last Day, and a Fat Guy's Movie Food Review, the box office, and the home cinema roundup.
Because we can, can!
There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kuykendall Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies. Finishing up the movie reviews, we have one more to talk about, and that is Rabin, The Last Day. This French-Israeli docudrama examines the assassination of Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin and what led up to the event. Now, I don't have a trailer for this one because it's in Hebrew. I tend to not play foreign trailers, but this is a foreign film. Like I said, it's a co-production between France and Israel. And the best way I can describe it is it's kind of like the Israeli version of JFK, Oliver Stone's JFK, because it is about a controversial leader who was beloved by a certain group of people and his assassination. And while they found the guy who did it, because he was right there, it's not as snappy as Oliver Stone's JFK. And it's a very different movie, but it does take that sort of backroom look at it. And a good chunk of it's about the investigators trying to figure out how this guy got in there, how this guy got past security. But it also examines the very right-wing Jewish group in Israel that was going after him. Because if you don't know the history, Yitzhak Rabin was involved in the Oslo Peace Accords, and he was extending an olive branch to the Palestinians, Yasser Arafat. And Bill Clinton was involved, but he just happened to be the president at the time. He did, you know, it wasn't his thing. But it was the essential trying to mend fences in the two-state solution in Israel. And a lot of the right wing of Israel, the hardcore Zionists, I mean the real conservative Zionists, were not happy about this. They felt that they were giving away land. They were bending over or rolling over and allowing the Palestinians more than they deserved. And it's a very icky, messy political struggle there. And that's what made him such a controversial leader. And I mean, now we've got Benjamin Netanyahu who actually is in the movie because he became prime minister after Rabin. And we have a very different situation. One thing that I found personally fascinating about this movie is, a lot of people know, about 2 years ago, I traveled to Israel and I was visiting the Jerusalem Film Festival and had a really interesting time sampling Israeli film. And all the films I saw, there was this handful of sort of culture, I'd refer to them as cultural films. There was like this one film I saw, it was a documentary about this guy who nobody knows in the States. It's a very Israeli guy. And he was like a singer. And so that was just sort of like a cultural biopic on this guy or a documentary about him. But most of the movies that I saw out there that were from Israel, that were made sort of grassroots Israel films, they dealt with three things. The one of them was the Holocaust, obviously. There's still a lot of examination of that time. It's a big deal. And I mean, it's a big deal in America, but it's a real big deal over there in Israel, you know. So there was also a certain amount of films about the loss of very traditional religious elements. The movie Get, which was about a woman trying to get a divorce, that was one of the big films of the festival. And that showed the struggle between old school Judaism and the laws and sort of how more progressive, liberal, modern Israelis live. And there's a conflict there. And then the third one is stuff basically about Israel and Palestine. There's a lot of things about the fighting, the conflict. There's border dispute issues. There's people working at the border and the threats that are there. There's military information. There's a movie. It eventually got released here called, I think, A Borrowed Identity, but it was called Dancing Arabs in the international title. And that was about a young Palestinian boy whose father was involved in some of the insurgency. And he just wanted to get an education. He falls in love with a Jewish girl, goes to a Jewish school and pretends to be another kid who's a Jewish kid just to get access, because that's what he wanted to do. And he was being dumped upon because he was Palestinian. But there's a lot of stuff also about the two-state solution, and there's a lot of contention over there about what Rabin was doing. So I got an interesting framework of this when I saw it. Otherwise, it's very heavy on the news footage. It's very heavy on the long, drawn-out, very deliberate courtroom proceedings. And it does have four or five different sort of witches stirring the brew in terms of the story and the plot. It's an interesting movie because it's not told from an American perspective. And that's what I found fascinating when I went there and I was watching these movies about the two-state solution in Israel and Palestine and how they're trying to work together and at times failing a lot at it at times. And sometimes actually having a very sort of nervous peace throughout the whole thing, which is 90% of the time. But it's completely outside of my framework culturally. So that's what makes Rabin the Last Day so interesting, because you're watching this stuff happen to another country and there's almost no American perspective at all, which gives us a more of a world perspective on this. So if you're at all interested in sort of Rabin and what he meant to a lot of the people in Israel, both good and bad, this is an interesting movie. It runs long and it's very deliberate, but it's worth checking out. I'm going to say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. I'm going to try one thing really quick, and it's something I've never done, but I figured might start doing these sort of things. I'm doing Fat Guy movie food reviews, because this week I was very fortunate, and Sony sent me a care package with a bunch of Ghostbusters stuff. Now, I know Ghostbusters, the remake, is getting anger thrown at it and everything, but, you know, the movie's coming out. It's a freight train. It's happening, and then just go or don't, and like it or don't. But as studios do, they market the stuff. I got a t-shirt and a book from the movie about that's supposedly written by the characters in the movie. It also came with a box of microwave popcorn, which is always nice to have. But it also came with the Key Lime Slime Twinkies, a box of those, and a packet of the Ecto Coolers from Hi-C that they brought back. They had these back 30 years ago. So I was like, hey, this is great. You know, I'm not above being bribed to talk about your movie if you send me food. So I haven't seen the movie. It could be good. It could be terrible. But you know what? It's kind of fun to get sort of those movie tie-in food. So my family and I, we had them. And the Ecto Cooler, I was a little bit too old to be drinking Hi-C juice boxes back in 1984. So I didn't have the connection to the Ecto Cooler that I know some people who are a little bit younger than me did. I mean, I know there's a huge fan base for it. The only reason you know it's green is you have to pour it out. I mean, it's in a juice box. You don't even see it. But you can pour it out. It's green. It looks like antifreeze. Don't get it mixed up. But it's good. It's essentially tangerine and orange. And so, you know, it's just colored green. But the one that, the Twinkies, I was impressed. Now, I mean, it's not key lime pie. It's not like going down to the Keys and getting a real honest to God key lime pie, but the filling has a key lime flavor to it. And it just goes really, really well with that sponge cake. I really enjoyed those Twinkies. So the Key Lime Slime Twinkies, if you can find them, I will probably try and find some and take them with me to my Ghostbusters screening just so I can eat them while I watch the movie when that happens later this summer. I see Ecto Cooler. It's apparently back in stores. You may have to search for it because it's a little hard to find right now. I'm sure come July it's going to be much more available. But yeah, you know, I'm going to say that both the Hi-C Ecto Cooler kind of rocks, but the Key Lime Slime Twinkies totally rock. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk real quick about the box office. Last week I said the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles was going to come in with $35 million. I was like right on the money with that one. That was probably the most accurate prediction I've ever done. X-Men dropped quite a bit to $23 million. And then Me Before You, that awful film, did a little bit better than expectations with about $19 million. It's not going to be this billion-dollar movie. It's just going to leg its way through August. No pun intended, since it's about a guy who's in a wheelchair. Popstar Never Stop Never Stopping was right about at industry expectations with $4.7 million. Kind of unimpressive in terms of the movies. It's been a little bit unimpressive. Once Captain America Civil War had its opening, everything else has been kind of mediocre in terms of opening weekends. This weekend, you know, some people are saying Warcraft. I wouldn't be surprised if The Conjuring 2 wins. I think Warcraft's going to struggle. It just has a lot of bad buzz, terrible reviews. And it's, I think, 10 years too late. So I'm going to say Conjuring 2, maybe $30 million? Who knows? You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. First one I want to talk about is Zootopia, a charming film. Just hit $1 billion worldwide in the theaters. Now you can take it home on DVD, Blu-ray, and also 3D Blu-ray. They still make those. Fantastic family movie. It was the first in the string of massive hits that Disney is having and will continue to have this year because they've got Finding Dory, Doctor Strange, and Star Wars Rogue One on the docket for the rest of the year. Also, 13 Hours, The Secret Soldiers of Benghazi, ironically, on the day that Hillary Clinton claims victory in the Democratic primaries, The Secret Soldiers of Benghazi hits Blu-ray and DVD. Hail Caesar, which is a neat little Coen Brothers movie, love letter to old Hollywood, partly a musical, but not in an annoying way. It's fun. It flew under the radar. It's not the most well-known. It's sort of like, it's going to probably be remembered as like Burn After Reading, but I enjoyed it. I really did enjoy Hail Caesar. Also, Anomalisa is out, the animated film by Charlie Kaufman. A couple other titles, Mr. Right, Jarhead 3, The Siege, and then of course Star Trek The Next Generation has gotten a Blu-ray box set release, so you can get the whole doggone thing and put it on your shelf. That's it for this week. Next week I'm going to be talking about Central Intelligence and Finding Dory. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.